So this Sunday is the last Sunday for covering the series of topics on what's called the five hindrances. And to introduce the hindrances today, I'd like to try to make an analogy for you. I used to live up on Skyline Boulevard and up in the foothills up here in the coastal range. And when I had to come down to town, I'd come down the Woodside Road, and you get kind of a beautiful view at times from there. And oftentimes, the view would be somewhat like today, and you couldn't really see that far off in the distance. It was either smoggy or hazy or cloudy or foggy or something. And but every once in a while, maybe after a rainy day and a windy day, there would be a spectacular view of the mountains, the hills in the East Bay. You see right across the bay. And usually it was kind of a shock to see them. Really, they're over there? You know, I didn't, you know, you can spend many, you know, months and time not realizing those hills are over there. And when it's really clear, they can seem really close by even. Feel like almost part of our environment, part of our ecology that we're here. And it's going to be quite exquisite to kind of have that clarity in the atmosphere that allows us to see across and see the bay a little bit. And so I used to enjoy that periodically. And then imagine that you have one of these beautiful days. Maybe you're driving down from the mountains up there and you see across the bay to the East Bay Hills. And it's just really exquisite. Every once in a while, every few years, even be a little bit patches of snow you could see in the distance on Mount Hamilton. And it's really great. And then the mind starts thinking about, it'd be really great if I could go up to the Sierras this winter. How am I going to manage to do that? It'd be really great. I wonder where I could stay. I wonder what kind of skis I could borrow. I wonder how. And pretty soon the mind is in its story of desire, of thinking about what it wants. And as the mind gets pulled into the stories of desire, it loses touch with the beautiful view that's there. Because the mind's been pulled in on itself. Or you see the beautiful view, you're enjoying it, and you realize the reason why you usually don't see across the bay is the smog. All those people who drive those cars. How could those people, you're not noticing yet, you're driving a car, but you know, all those people, how could they be driving a car? And we've got to do something with these cars, and they use so much gas, and the poor people in Fresno, they get all our smog, and this is really, you know. And we get pulled into a story of aversion. And it might be some very good discernment going on, but we get pulled into this world of our thoughts, our story making, and that view, that crystal clear view, recedes from attention, from presence, from being there for it. Or perhaps you're just really lethargic, really bored, lethargic, lazy, no inertia, you're coming down that mountain, you see the beautiful view, that's nice. It's nice, you know, and the mind just kind of shuts down, you know, it's kind of like, oh, nothing's really important, I don't really have energy for anything. And you hardly even pay attention to it because the mind, again, sinks into itself, sinks into kind of lack of energy. Or you're coming down the hill and you see the beautiful view, that's great. And then the mind doesn't know what to pay attention to. Should I pay attention to the over there? But I need to pay attention to the road I'm driving. But which road? And, you know, and should I look at my rear view mirror? And I don't even know where I'm going yet. If I'm going down the hill, should I go shopping or should I go exercise? What should I do? And the mind is kind of restless and jumping around, you know, looking here and looking at that. And there's a car going by and there's a beautiful oak tree. And just the mind just doesn't settle anywhere. And it can't enjoy the beautiful view because the mind is restless, jumps around too much. And then, kind of similar to restlessness perhaps, but a different animal, is perhaps coming down that mountain road, there is doubt, and or indecision, or wavering, or hesitation. And you come down the hill, and you're not just sure you want to go down the hill. Or, you know, is this really the right thing to do? You know, and you feel the hesitation, you kind of go into this world of doubt and kind of rumination. You know, what's the right thing to do? Should I go back up? Should I go down? Should I move to Wyoming? What should I do? You know. And so the mind gets lost in this another story. And it no longer sees the pristine view of these hills and the clarity of the atmosphere. And so these are kind of stories of the five hindrances. Desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and agitation, and then doubt. And there are ways in which we lose a lot. We get pulled into another world that's not so productive or useful, kind of drains us or disconnects us of something very important. And in particular, in the tradition of Buddhism, mindfulness, these are things that can disconnect us from a clarity of mind, the capacity for the mind to be clear, to be present, to be here right now, and see things and feel things and be present and see what is happening right here in this room. To be alive and present with some vitality, some clarity about where we are. That's always available here. And the smog, the haze of the mind, is not something that's caused by other people, but rather has to do with the mood, the activity, the concerns, the preoccupations of the mind, and what we let have the upper hand in our mind. If we let the story-making, discursive mind have the upper hand, we'll get pulled into it. And things can get really hazy really quickly, really smoggy. If we can not live in the discursive mind and get pulled and sucked into it, then the clarity of the mind, clarity of the heart, is much more available right here. And one of the very important aspects of mindfulness practice is the part that tries to help us to pull out of the world of discursive thinking. It isn't that thinking is bad or wrong, but discursive thinking can be like quicksand. And you get pulled into it, and it's very hard to get pulled out. And when we're pulled into it, we lose that clarity, the mind's capacity to be clear, the mind's capacity to be free, the mind's capacity to be fully here in a way that's stress-free. It's very hard to do when the mind gets pulled into the world of story-making and discursive thoughts. So one of the very liberating and very satisfying things of mindfulness practice is when we can learn to shut off discursive thinking. Doesn't mean your thinking stops, but story-making and kind of thinking and ruminating about things can come to an end. And you can be present and with much more clarity of what's happening right here. So doubt is one of the fuels, catalysts, for a lot of discursive thinking. And it's part of the problem of doubt in practice is that it can create this film, this haze over our experience, because we get lost in these stories around indecision. What should we do? And I can't do, and all these things. The word in Pali for doubt is vichikicca. And it has the connotation of wavering, of indecision, of being agitated. Some people will translate it as skeptical doubt, with the idea that not all doubt is a problem, not all doubt clouds over the mind. Some doubt, some kind of doubting actually can clarify the mind, can help us look more carefully and say, what's going on here? I'm not sure I understand this. Let's penetrate here. But there's skeptical doubt, or there's wavering doubt, that causes us to hesitate, to hold back, to get lost in the world of discursive thoughts. And it can be a huge hindrance. It's said that doubt, as one of the hindrances, is the most dangerous of the hindrances, more dangerous than desire or ill will. And part of the reason it's said it's the most dangerous is that doubt is the one that can cause a person to give up their practice. So you have doubt your practice, doubt your ability to practice, doubt the teaching, doubt I'll do something else. I'll go to the Sierras. You know, I don't have to go sit. And that's, not practicing will undercut our ability to wisely engage with the other hindrances. Because if you stop practicing, you're not going to pay careful attention to when desire arises or ill will arises. And then they get, you get in trouble. So the analogy of the clear atmosphere of seeing across the bay, and using that by the clarity of the mind, for me points to the idea that mindfulness is something very simple. It's not an elaborate technique of applying a lot of elaborate kind of spiritual technology towards our life, but it's just simply noticing what is happening now, just simply being present for what's happening now, with some clarity, some immediacy, some directness. And to have some doubt about mindfulness, the value and importance of just being mindful here, borders on having some doubt about the value of being present for life in general. Because being, mindfulness and being present for life are the same thing. And a lot of us don't spend a lot of time being present for life in some quality way. And so we doubt the value of just being fully present. And, so doubt. So doubt has a function of keeping us unwilling to apply ourselves. It's one of the big paralyzing aspects of doubt, is we can be sitting here wanting to practice, wanting to be mindful, wanting to engage in practice, wanting to go and sit, and we have doubts about whether it's useful or whether we can or whatever. And so we don't want to apply ourselves. We don't want to try. We don't feel that the sitting or that mindfulness has any purpose, any value. So why should I do this? I'm enthralled in my desire fantasy. Why should I wake up? Why should I pull myself out of that world of the discursive thought? That question, why, has to do, in Buddhist terminology, has to do with doubt. Having some doubt about the value of clarity, of being present and independent from that discursive quicksand. There's a lot of times doubt is operating where we wouldn't think of it as doubt, where it has the function of we don't understand the value of presence. And so, because we don't understand the value of it, the tremendous value of it, we think other things have more value. And so we're willing to kind of go off then into other discursive realms or other activities that pulls us out of being fully present. So doubt has a function then of keeping us from applying ourselves. It also has the function of keeping us wavering, kind of just, kind of agitated, restless. And doubt can be very convincing. The doubt often has to do with the story we tell ourselves. So doubt is not necessarily something that is innate in the mind, but involves, we're telling ourselves a story. I can't do this. I'm not good enough to do this. I have doubt about my ability. I can't do this particular practice. This practice is only meant for great sages of the East who live in the Himalayas, and I can't do it. Or this teaching is not so good, this Buddhism stuff. These Buddhists are always talking about no self. And, that doesn't make any sense at all. And so because that doesn't make any sense, the whole thing must not make any sense. And so I have a lot of doubt about whether I should even show up. And so there's a story that we're interested in, we get caught in. And so it's very important with doubt to investigate and see what is the story that's behind the doubt. What is the belief? And upon what authority do we have that belief? What are we telling ourselves? And there's two things to be done here. One is to question the story, to question the belief. Is it really valid? And the other is to understand that there's a different way of being alive than being lost in discursive thought. And so sometimes we can resolve our doubts, our stories, and sometimes we can just pull ourselves out of the quicksand. And by pulling ourselves out of the quicksand, we say, wow, why was I lost there? What was I doing? What was I thinking? But as long as we're in the quicksand, it's very hard to even see the path out. And so one of the advantages of someone who does a lot of meditation is over time to learn the skill, learn the ability to pull yourself out of story making so you can get a whole different vantage point of what's going on. Because if you're trying to solve your problems always from within the world of discursive thought, thinking your way out, there's a lot of things that are not going to work by thinking your way out. there's a whole other opportunity available, but you step out of thought. Kind of take a little switch in the mind that maybe can turn off discursive thinking, or use the mindfulness or clear seeing to kind of shift the focus of where you're residing out of thought, out of discursive thinking, to clear seeing. In the first category of kind of resolving the issues, looking at what we believe, looking at the stories, it can be useful to it's very useful to do that. There is a time and place for that. And so, for example, studying the Dharma more. If you have doubt about the Dharma, about the practice, study more. Understand what you're doing. Maybe there's a good reason why you have doubt. Maybe you haven't really understood the basic premise, the ideas, the teachings of the Dharma well enough to really want to apply yourself. Maybe you haven't understood the instructions for practice well enough. And so you have reasons to have doubt. What should I do here, and how should I do it, and when should I do it, and all kinds of questions. So sometimes doubt is resolved by learning more, or talking to a teacher, and exploring with a teacher. These are my doubts. This is what I don't know. Is there something you can help me with? And the teacher says, "Oh yeah, it's really easy. You should sit 40 minutes every day." Oh, okay, that's easy. And sometimes in investigating our thinking, it can be helpful to realize that some of the things we're interested in are not spiritually helpful things to think about. The Buddha said that one of the primary causes for doubt is thinking about, is it what he called inappropriate attention or unwise thinking, paying attention to the wrong things. And oddly enough, perhaps, for Buddhism, it focuses so much on not-self, one of the things that's considered to be an unwise thing to reflect on is to think too much about yourself, about the nature of yourself, who am I, who was I in the past, who will I be in the future. All kinds of thoughts have to do about self that's in the context. Is sometimes kind of a dead end. It's kind of like in this maze or in the quicksand. And so even though Buddhism has this tremendously profound teaching on not-self, to be thinking about it too much, thinking about the self too much, is a dead end. And so it says, you will have a lot of doubts if you try to figure out the metaphysical self. Is there self? Is there no self? Don't think about that. The not-self teaching in Buddhism is not meant to be something to be understood with your thinking. And you start thinking about it, look out. We might not be able to pull you out of the quicksand. The not-self teaching is it's a teaching about something you'll see if you can stop seeing things through the filter of your thinking. It has to do with something you see, not something you believe. So the Buddha said it's inappropriate to think a lot about self. That can be a dead end. So anyway, so certain thinkings, certain kinds of things are not useful to think about, so it's useful just to drop them. Other things are useful to think about. And one of the things the Buddha said was useful to think about, or to address or look at, was to look at where is the tension? Where is the obscuration? Where is the stress in the psyche, in the heart, in the mind, in the body right now? And if you can see right now where that is, and then learn the wise way of attending to that stress, then you have the opportunity to look beyond the stress to where that clear view is, to learn to let go of that. And that's a lot simpler than metaphysical questions about self and who am I, who am I not, but rather where is the stress? Where is the tension? Where is the suffering? So there's certain things that can be clarified by studying the Dharma, talking to teachers, exploring with Dharma friends, and that's useful to resolve doubts. And then there's a whole other area of resolving doubts, which happens with applying ourselves more fully in the practice. And one of the things to do with doubts, if you feel a doubt around practice, if you can, don't believe it. Don't let it have the upper hand that keeps you from making the effort to practice. It can be there in the background, like a little pesky fly. But don't listen to it. You just say, okay, I'm going to, every day my commitment is to sit and meditate every morning. I'm going to do it even though I have some doubts of whether this is really the right morning. It's kind of cold, it's cozy in bed. I don't really think that it's going to have much value this particular morning to sit. That kind of train of thought is a movement of doubt. We have some doubt about its value. One of the ways to deal with doubt is when we see it, is to not buy into its messages, to its commands, and just kind of go ahead and do it anyway. Apply oneself. Another way of dealing with it is to practice mindfulness on it, to look at it very intently and to see it for what it is. This is doubt. If your ability to see is stronger than your ability to... if your ability to see is stronger than the doubt's ability to see you, then you have the upper hand. But if the voices of the authority of doubt is stronger than the authority of your observation, you get pulled into the doubt. And that's one of the things we're trying to do in mindfulness, is to have a greater power in observation than the power that other things have over us, so that we get pulled into this beautiful state of seeing clarity, so that the breeze comes through and clears out the bay, so we can see the hills on the other side, as opposed to kind of living continually in the smog. So we're constantly trying to develop our capacity to be present and to see, so it becomes a strength, a power that we can have with us. And it's really phenomenal how strong the ability to see can become. And even in myself, practices for a long time, I can see that the power of it wane and wax to some degree, because it's always a constant. Once you have it, you have it. But rather it comes and goes to some degree. And I'm still amazed, at times when my clarity is really strong. And I'm also amazed at times when it's not. It comes and goes. But, the more we practice, the more it becomes kind of second nature, the more it kind of is a muscle that's always there, a resource which is readily available close by. It's said that doubt is also in the arsenal of the ego's attempt to protect itself. That one of the challenges that happens with clear seeing is that as we start seeing more and more clearly, we tend to see how our self-centeredness operates. And our self-centeredness as a kind of neurotic tendency has many different manifestations. One of them, for example, is trying to build up a sense of self to show other people, or to protect a sense of self, an image of ourselves, self-image, for example. And when there's enough clear seeing, the trap of self-image is seen as a trap, is seen as something which is not serving oneself, not very useful to have. You're not very free. And so when you see the possibility of living without self-image or without defending oneself in some neurotic way or building up a sense of self in a neurotic way, then sometimes the mind will send up a lot of doubt, often fueled by fear. Oh, you don't have to do that. It's really important to have a sense of self. That's what the therapists say, strong sense of self. And you're supposed to have a strong sense of self, but... You can start to pulling out all these good reasons that are not really good reasons about why you're not supposed to let go of this. And so sometimes doubt is a movement of the ego, egotism, to protect itself from that clarity that is undefended. That kind of clarity, the idea of a clear atmosphere, you see clearly right through it. I think so. For me, it's so beautiful. It's kind of like a clear window. It's something really well cleaned. And you can't see through the window. You don't even know it's there. Sometimes people run into doors, sliding doors, because glass doors, because they don't see them. But it's not, you don't even see that it's there. When mindfulness, when presence is strong, when the heart is really open, it's kind of like the mind has become so transparent that you don't see it. But the glass is still there, right? The mind is still there, but it's so transparent you don't see it. But if you don't see it, it doesn't do you any good, does it? But to learn to trust that kind of transparency, or that kind of emptiness of mind, of seeing, where it doesn't have to have anything in it. That part of the psyche, that part of awareness, that doesn't have to be contracted or related to anything or concerned about anything or preoccupied by anything, but just kind of like who we are as an experiential, who we are experientially in the moment right now is as empty as empty space, as empty as a clear window that you can't see the window is even there. Now that's very frightening, because all the usual reference points that we have for who we are and what we think we need and what we need to protect ourselves from is absent in that kind of clarity, in that kind of emptiness. So doubt is one of the things that comes up as a protection against having to, or against relaxing into that emptiness, into that clarity. Oh no, this is not safe, I shouldn't do it, I'm not ready. Some other time would be good. So doubt. Doubt will visit everyone who practices. I think that you should take that for granted. It's not a personal failing that doubt arises, but it is something to be recognized and seen clearly for what it is, so that it doesn't limit us. And in looking at how it limits us, I'll repeat one thing I said before, and that is doubt doesn't always look like some active kind of wondering, is this accurate or is this true or not true, or having some formal doubt. But it can simply be the form of not understanding the value that's possible, not understanding the tremendous possibility and potential that the practice has to offer. So we don't give ourselves as fully over to it as we have the ability to do it, because we don't understand how powerful it actually is. Do not trust or have confidence in how radically we can be transformed through the practice. Because we don't understand how radically we can be transformed, we can be liberated, then we hold back. We don't try. We hold back, and then it's easier to get hooked by the other hindrances, by desire and ill will. Those are really important to do. Pursue those things. So the last thing to say about doubt, as a spiritual hindrance on the Buddhist path, the fundamental doubt is doubt about what is and is not the path. And it's quite reasonable to have doubt about what is and isn't the path until a person has really tasted the fruit of what the path has to offer. If a person's never practiced or never tasted the fruits or the benefit that come with the practice, then it makes sense to have doubt, because you haven't seen it yet. You don't really know for yourself that this leads to a certain fruit, certain benefit. And so initially there has to become some act of faith, I suppose, goodwill faith, that, oh, this is worthwhile to do. But as a person engages in a spiritual practice, it's useful to begin appreciating the benefits that are coming through the practice, the fruits that are coming. So you recognize, oh, this path is onward leading. The path works. And that seeing the benefits of the path can happen in one moment of mindfulness. We see in a moment of mindfulness, the mind is not caught. The mind is free. Oh, that's what freedom is like. I know what freedom is like, even that moment, briefly. I think that's the direction the path goes. Remaining caught is not the path. If I continue thinking about, continue being clinging and holding on tight to whatever it is I'm holding on tight to, the path is not found in clinging. Some people cling to Buddhism. You cling to Buddhism, there's no Buddhist path there. But if you've tasted the fruit of what it's like to have a mind, a heart, which has released itself from holding, then you know the fruit, and you know what the path is about. And that experience of release, that experience of freedom, can happen in small little moments in a day, and it can happen in really big ways, very dramatically, so that it really gets your attention, like you'll never be the same again. But to begin seeing the benefits. And I think for people who practice mindfulness, one of the things I'm very keen on trying to get across is that a moment of mindfulness is a moment of freedom. Or a moment of mindfulness is valuable in and of itself. A moment of mindfulness is valuable in and of itself. I've known people who practice mindfulness and they were measuring the success of their mindfulness or the purpose of the mindfulness by what it was going to do in the future. If I get really practice a lot, if I go on retreat a lot, if I do a lot of this mindfulness, then eventually I'll have so much concentration, such strong mindfulness, eventually something wonderful will happen. And I've known people who have had that approach and have gotten bitter. They practice and practice and go on retreats. Ajahn Sumedho says, if sitting was the point, chickens would be enlightened. So now people have gotten actually bitter because they've kind of had this kind of thinking. They're always putting something in the future, their benefit, looking, waiting for something to happen. And they never learned how to appreciate the value of each moment of mindfulness. This moment right here. Paying attention, noticing what's happening here. It takes a while to really learn that. It's not so obvious initially, perhaps. But each moment. And there can be greater benefits down the line. By practicing and going to retreats and practicing regularly, building concentration, building power of mindfulness. There are things and benefits that are quite different that can happen down the line. But both are true. But if you understand the value moment by moment, then you're never going to be bitter. Because you know, oh, I never attained some great enlightenment. I'm not the next Buddha. But I had a good time along the way. Each moment was good. Each moment. If you really understand the value of one moment of mindfulness, perhaps you'll not be plagued by doubt or sucked into it. So those are my thoughts. We have a couple of minutes. If any of you would like to express any doubts, this would be a good time. Right behind you, Betsy.
Thanks, Gil. I'm one of those people that wakes up in the morning and thinks that it would be really nice to stay in bed instead of meditate for 30 or 40 minutes. And so if I'm thinking that every moment is a moment of mindfulness and that has value just in itself, I would think that if I just laid in bed and, noticed how comfortable the bed is, that I wouldn't need to sit for the 40 minutes.
Great.
So to me, it's kind of helpful to think that I'm trying to get somewhere. Otherwise, I just stay in bed.
Well, yeah, so that's very, very nice. I think you need to... I think that's why it's useful to have both understandings together. Understanding the value of mindfulness in the moment, and also understanding of some process and goal that's into the future, the benefits we're going to have. I've known lots of Buddhists, and I saw in Japan this a lot, where they had a certain kind of philosophy that led to that kind of rationalization. Everything I do is practice. So I don't have to really practice. I don't have to sit. I don't have to do anything. And you know, everything is practice, but you know, if you're sitting, just sitting around kind of drinking your sake and picking your nose. You know, it's, you know, I'm sure it could be great practice, but but you know, if it's rationalized by saying everything is practice, therefore I'm not going to really. So one of the things to do is, for example, situation like yours, is to do a trial and error approach. Experiment a little bit. Take a 3-month period and be totally dedicated for 3 months to get up and sit every morning, no matter what. Just do it kind of like, you know, unless your house is burning or something, you know. You know, get up and sit. And then, after 3 months, stop. And then take a few weeks and just stay in bed. Linger, just stay in bed until 11, you know. Yeah. Make sure you have your espresso coffee machine next to your bed with a timer. It goes on at 10:30 when you go, just right there. You pull it out, and you know, and you have a dog, then get the paper, and so you don't have to get out of bed, and you know, just do it really well for a few weeks, and then compare which helps you the best in your life. And my guess is that sitting in the morning, getting up and really sitting on a regular basis, if you do long enough, like 3 months, you realize actually in the bigger picture, this is actually much healthier and better. It brings you more happiness and well-being than what happens if you linger in bed. The lingering in bed provides comfort and happiness in the moment, but not in some bigger picture for our lives. And that's, you know, in a sense, that's that first hindrance of desire or attachment to sensual desire, attachment to comfort, which is such a big hindrance to discovering this greater benefit. Does that make sense? Kind of? Mm-hmm. Try it. They're good. Let me know. Max. Wait for the mic if you don't mind, please.
You seem to be emphasizing practicing in the morning, and that just doesn't seem to suit me so well. I kind of, when I have practice, I do it in the evening. Would you care to talk about that a little bit?
I think that different people have different styles or different things that works for their system. And I think that most people find it works best to sit first thing in the morning or early in the morning, you know, some point when before the busyness of the day has kicked in. But there are some people for whom that doesn't work, and sitting in the evening is fine. You know, I think the regularity is important, and sitting in the evening, what works for your schedule, who you are, or your psyche, or it's fine. There's advantages sitting in the evening. When I do both, I find it's nice to do both. But the advantage of sitting in the evening or in the late afternoon is it actually helps, sometimes can help process what happened during the day. And then you go to sleep. Sleep doesn't have to process it. Sleep more deeply. We have two mics now.
No. I sometimes have doubts about Dharma teaching, and this is definitely a present company accepted comment, because of the person who's sharing the Dharma, that I pick up on some mixed motives in that person, or I think I do, or I'm judgmental in some way, or it's not the right chemistry or something, and then I have doubts about the teaching that was the content.
So, doubt about the teaching because of the nature of the person who's giving the teaching. Is that what you're saying?
Right, it might be advice about my own practice, but I have a mixed response because of that.
Uh-huh. And so that's an interesting thing. So sometimes it's completely neurotic to doubt the teacher. You know, it's nothing to do with the teacher at all, just all this projection that goes on. That can happen. And sometimes it's completely accurate. Who is that guy, you know, the gal? You know, what's... What? And that, we're talking about hypocritical. And I mean, I've known enough Buddhist teachers who've gone to their students and said, it's very important you don't sleep around. Absolutely, you should not sleep around. But they were sleeping around. You know, what's that about? You know, do you listen to that kind of advice from someone? So I think it's important to trust a little bit yourselves. I remember hearing a tape some years ago of a spiritual teacher. It wasn't really a Buddhist one. And he kind of ran a cult. Not kind of, it was a cult. Very strong cult. And someone gave me his tape to listen to, his talk. And I got almost nauseous listening to it. I felt so terrible. And part of the reason was that some of the things he said seemed so manipulative, so horrible to have someone say. And other things he said, I can imagine myself saying. And that's what made me nauseous. It was oh no. And I listened to that tape, I don't think I ever want to teach again. I said, oh no. And so there, you know, there can be a lot of good mixed in, you know, what can be bad. I think there's always good to have some, there's a healthy kind of doubt of any teacher, even the best teacher. I think you should all, I think there's a very, I think it's very respectful of a teacher to be questioning the teacher, what the teacher says, and not take what the teacher says as being the truth, but rather kind of engaging and questioning it in your own mind. Is this really accurate? How do I understand that? There's a way of doing that which is not skeptical doubt, which is not a hindrance. I think it's actually a respectful thing to do, to question that. And then if you do that kind of questioning, and you can go to a teacher and the teacher can be part of that questioning, then maybe you're in a safe place. Even if the teacher is a little bit off, because the teacher is in process also, but the teacher is willing to be in process. But if you have questions about the teaching coming to the teacher and the teacher is not willing to engage you, then maybe it's not a safe place to be. So you know, go talk to the teacher and say, you know, I have these doubts. I have doubts about you. If you don't say you have doubts, if you can't tell a teacher you have doubts about a teacher, I would say it's not a safe teacher to be with. And it's good to test the teacher. You know, it's also good to test teachers. People don't test me here very much. Maybe because I haven't told you you're supposed to. But it's good to kind of poke a little bit and see, you know, see when the teacher kind of, you know, see when the teacher kind of fails. And then there's a phenomena of seeing that teachers have shortcomings, and realizing that in spite of those shortcomings, that teacher has something to teach me. And is there some usefulness there? And so, okay, well, I'll go and tune into or use or adopt what is useful here, and what doesn't seem to be useful here because of these shortcomings, I think I'll let go of. And I think that, you know, my assumption is, you know, pretty much all teachers have some kind of shortcoming. And so there has to be some wisdom about how to relate to those shortcomings. And, you know, those shortcomings enough for us to kind of run out the door screaming, or are those shortcomings something that we can just kind of say, well, hopefully he, she is working on that. And I just, you know, when they gave advice about parenting, I won't listen to that because he doesn't seem to know what he's talking about. But, you know, maybe he knows some other things. When I went to study with my first Zen teacher, when I first got there to the place, I immediately got the sense that I couldn't approve of this person's lifestyle. Somehow the lifestyle the teacher was leading, I couldn't approve of. But I thought, I think I can learn Zen from this person. And because I made that distinction, I don't know if it was a wise distinction to have made. I'm not saying it was a wise distinction to have made. Maybe I shouldn't have made that distinction. Maybe that way a person conducts their lives needs to have some harmony with what the teachings are about. But I made that distinction, and because I made that distinction, that protected me to some degree when the teacher had a great big scandal. Because I already knew I couldn't quite trust the teacher in certain areas, but in other areas I could. So, those are my thoughts right now. It's a great question. It's a huge, huge, very, very good question.
Pretty good answer to it.
Hey. You weren't listening. Last one, then we should start.
Oh, the last one. I hate that.
The reason I do that, maybe I don't have to, but sometimes when we're running late, I figure people are getting kind of restless. And if they're told this is the last one, they can relax and know, oh yes, it's under control. I just have to listen, you know, there's one more thing and then I can go. I'm not going to, you know, force
Except the person asking the last question. You can't win.
Okay.
One of the things that you said is hopefully you'll remove all discursive thought. There'll be this place where you won't have that. And for me, one of the questions that comes up around the hindrances is, if I'm paying attention, I notice some form of hindrance in almost every moment that I'm experiencing. I can experience, I'm liking this, I'm not liking that, I'm kind of feeling some doubt here, you know. And what you said today for me really brings up a lot of my own self-doubt right now. I'm experiencing that in my life right now. I haven't been sitting as often every day and having doubt. You know, and questioning whether I should be teaching introduction because, you know, I'm not sitting as much. You know, and so I feel like, oh, well, therefore I'm not worthy. I don't have anything to share, and I can notice myself pulling back a little bit, withdrawing. And so, one of the things that comes through while you said that, I said, well, yeah, you know, it sort of goes to this this young lady's point too. You know, it's like a Dharma teacher will come, they're a Buddhist monk, and they'll talk about, you know, their practice. And I compare myself as a householder to that, and I think, oh, man, you know, that's not going to happen. And so I think what I'm really enjoying what you're saying today, Gil, is like just keep remembering to notice that, keep coming back to what's happening. Okay, yeah, I'm really having some doubt here. I'm really questioning myself. Does that mean I should stop, you know, or should I, you know, do something else, or should I just sort of continue forward, mm-hmm. keep sitting, you know, okay, start over 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, mm-hmm. 20 minutes, whatever, you know, and see what the fruit of that is. So, you know, every time, regardless of the teacher, there's something there for me,
right,
if I pay attention to it and I'm honest with myself about it. And so, you know, thanks for that today.
Thank you. Couple of things I feel like saying in response. One is that I think it's easy for some people to have kind of a, I don't know what the right word is here, moralistic idea about what it means to be sitting every day, that you're supposed to be sitting every day and you're bright, you're really good Buddhist if you're sitting every day, and if you're not, you know, and if you're not sitting every day, you're not really doing it right and whatever. I mean, I know some teachers who don't sit every day. You know, there's various ways in which the path can unfold and develop for people. And what's required is honesty about how our path is unfolding and developing. But if you have a lot of doubt about the value of mindfulness, then probably you shouldn't be teaching people on mindfulness. Because then, I think probably in your voice, kind of, it's kind of the way you say it, it's not going to really be very convincing. You know, people are not going to understand the real value. So if you have doubt about the mindfulness practice, then don't. But if you have a lot of faith and confidence in it, just like for some reason you're not getting on the cushion or not doing it, but your confidence is there because you've tasted the fruit in the past, then we can look, you know, I wouldn't be moralistic about it. I would then look honestly at your life and the phase of your life, what you're doing, and what needs to happen right now, and be very careful in the moment not to be caught by that doubt. which is what you said. Well, it's 11 o'clock and you seem kind of attentive. Usually by 11 o'clock people are kind of like, so is this a topic that touched a chord? Yeah? So anyway, now I have doubts about stopping. So it is. So anyway, thank you very much.